I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now at 8:08 or ba oh ba Beijing time under a hazy nighttime sky. 2008 precision drummers and more fireworks than you can imagine launched the 29th Summer Olympics. The opening ceremony in Beijing may be the most expensive, the most watched spectacle in human history. With 15,000 performers, it featured 5,000 years of selected Chinese history, from the Great Wall of China to Chinese opera and astronauts, no mention of Chairman Mao or communist class struggle. We're going to have a report from Beijing from the opening ceremonies in just a few minutes. But first, what did all the symbolism mean? We want to hear about the opening ceremonies, but we are well aware many of you don't. Now, we just want to take a second at the beginning of Here and Now to make our commitment to you that over the next couple of weeks, whenever we talk about the Olympics, especially if we talk about results, which many of you don't want to hear until you watch for yourself at night, we are going to give you a warning and this sound. Signaling we are about to talk about the Olympics. So now, let's take a look at the opening ceremony. The sound must come again, as promised. I think we might be sick of that in a few days, but with us in the studio is Claire Conceson. She's Associate Professor of Drama at Tufts University, a researcher at Harvard University's Fairbanks Center for Chinese Studies. Her forthcoming book, Voices Carry, is the autobiography of the late Chinese actor and culture minister Ying Rocheng, if I said that correctly.
Ying Rocheng. Yes.
Well, Claire, welcome and happy ba o ba o ba to you.
Thank you.
80808. Claire's going to be telling us about some of the symbolism. We know about the number 8, that it means prosperity, and so this has been a carefully picked date. But there's another symbol that we saw floating around a lot. He. I'm not saying that correctly. What is that?
I think you're referring to the Chinese character he, which is part of the word for he ping, or peace and harmony.
And what are you seeing as you watch this? It seems like we're seeing a lot of attempts at peace and harmony.
Well, I think for China, this is a huge moment. And, you know, NBC keeps referring to the opening ceremonies as the greatest spectacle on earth. And other people in the press are calling it China's coming out party. And this truly is a great opportunity for China to define itself and present itself on a global stage. And it's also a huge expenditure for China, as you mentioned, the most expensive opening ceremonies. And that money is being spent as an investment in its world image. So I think the spectacle of the opening ceremonies is presenting a visual feast and a lot of interesting narratives and symbols. And one of these is China's desire to be seen as a peaceful nation that is promoting tranquility and unity.
How are you seeing that? Some of the things we've heard.
As you said, in the use of the character He for peace, and also in a lot of the performances that happened in the opening ceremonies, where you see broad groups of people unified through color and movement.
What colors are you seeing? What does that mean to you?
I think a lot of the colors that tend to be used in China are bright yellow and bright red, which of course read differently across cultures. And sometimes in the West, we associate red with blood or communism. In China, of course, red for the Communist Party is a positive symbol, according to the state. But it also signifies happiness and weddings and a lot of joyful things in their culture.
Well, speaking of weddings, I have a factoid here. At a Beijing marriage registry office, the staff said more than 1,500 new couples came to the office to register yesterday, three times the daily August average, because people are seeing this obviously as a time of possibility and promise and, as you said, peace and all of that. But you also mentioned that the state says it's the color. Now, we heard during the opening ceremonies about 2,000 women in headdresses representing the Hindus who came to China from India, 2,000 robed men representing the disciples of Confucius. These are state-sanctioned religions, which is faiths, which is all that's allowed in China. We didn't see anything, for instance, in this 5,000-year history in this huge pageant about the Cultural Revolution.
No, I think China's going to avoid the kind of thorny political narratives that have gained China bad press over the years and certainly over the days leading up to the Olympics. China really wants to promote positive messages, an openness to the world, modern technology, but also celebrate its unique history. This opening segment of the opening ceremonies was called Brilliant Civilization, leading up to when the athletes come into the stadium. And they want to show the world some of the inventions that they created and some of the wonderful contributions that they've made to world civilization. So those are the narratives and visual cues that you're going to see emphasized.
But is there going to be some debate as to whether or not those really were? I mean, they credited the compass, I believe, to Confucius, and the invention of gunpowder, invention of movable type. Some people debate that?
The history books don't debate it, that movable type print culture came to China long before Gutenberg and his press. But I think it's a chance for China to reassert its place in world history.
Well, let's go to Beijing, where Shira Springer of the Boston Globe attended the opening ceremonies today. Now, she's along with 91,000 other people in the stadium, so it's a little bit noisy there. Shira, are you there? Shira?
Hello.
Hi, Shira. I don't know how well you're going to hear me. You're at the stadium in Beijing, that beautiful Nest Stadium. Can you give us your impressions of the opening ceremony?
I mean, it really was absolutely spectacular. I mean, there were innovative performances. There were people flying all over the place. There was lots of fireworks and light displays, and you got just this mix of Chinese innovation and Chinese history and Chinese culture. These things can sometimes come off quite cheesy, perhaps overdone and overproduced, but everything here was very fresh, very fun, interesting, and even the things you kind of said to yourself, well, how exactly are they going to represent the invention of movable type? Walk away quite impressed with how they actually managed to do it, and just astounded at the amount of practice and attention to detail for everything in this ceremony.
It's Shira Springer of the Boston Globe, who's in the stadium, which is still, we can hear what's going on behind you. There have been thousands of performers. There are 91,000 people watching, not to mention the thousands of athletes who have paraded. Shira, we can hear you. You're talking about the innovations, but it's difficult to hear you, so I'm going to just ask one last question. Who lit the torch?
And so was the great part about the actual fighting. Not to spoil anything for anybody, but I'm going to have to.
Shira Springer, again, in Beijing, if you have given us a sense of the palpable energy there, but it's just real tough. So, Shira, we're going to be speaking to you over the next couple of weeks. Thank you so much, and enjoy. And we come back to the studio with Claire Conceson, an expert in things Chinese, sports, and arts. And Shira just said, I'm sure it was difficult to hear, that the man who lit the torch was a former Olympian, I think she was saying, but you saw some other significance too.
Well, I was wondering who it would be that would be lighting the torch, because they were keeping that under wraps. And my guess was that it would be someone who's important in sport history in China, but probably someone connected to the recent earthquake, because that is so much on the people's minds in China and on their hearts. And sure enough, Li Ning is a sports entrepreneur, a very wealthy man, and he donated 12.5 million renminbi, or Chinese currency, to the earthquake victims for immediate disaster relief. He won 6 medals at the 1984 Los Angeles Olympics, 3 gold medals, all in gymnastics. So he brings together 3 very interesting facets of what you would want in that special person to light the torch.
Well, you know, I'm going to bring in to join us now Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, who is following sort of the sports. There is a sports angle to this story.
Is that right? There's going to be a competition, too? This is magnificent.
In addition to all of this. Well, there's an athlete, lighting the torch, even though there's some politics behind it.
And a winner.
And what would you want people to look for? We're going to keep Claire here to talk more about some of the significance of the symbols we're seeing. But what athletes should we be looking for? What events?
I don't know quite where to start in talking about what athletes we should be looking for. Everybody coming to the Olympics always finds such a buffet of opportunities, and everybody has their own favorite sports. I think one of the interesting things that's happened in the Olympics recently Is there more female competitors every time another Olympics rolls around? And, of course, more team sports for women to compete in. And I think a lot of people pay attention to those because just as in this country with Title IX, we've seen women's sports become more important. That has spread around the world, no question about it.
Well, today, back to men's sports, though, Kobe Bryant and Yao Ming marched into the stadium, mega basketball stars. And on Sunday, the U.S. team meets China. LeBron James of the Cleveland Cavaliers, Kobe Bryant, as we said, versus China. Yao Ming of the Houston Rockets is going to be playing for China. So tell us more about this game.
Well, LeBron James has guaranteed a gold medal for the U.S., much to the dismay of some of his teammates who don't like it when you give locker room, bulletin board material to other teams. In this case, of course, the U.S. is hardly a lock. The defending champion, world champion, is Spain. The defending Olympic champion is Argentina. The U.S. has lost to seven different countries since the Olympics in Australia. So they're hardly a lock, although if you look at simply the talent and the income levels of the players, you'd have to say that this is a pretty impressive aggregation that the U.S. team is bringing over.
Okay, enough about sports. No.
Yeah, let's get back to spectacle.
Let's get back to the spectacle. Well, Bill, you're going to stay here. We want to talk more about the sports, but I do want to talk more about the spectacle because, Claire, about 4 billion people around the world will have watched this because of the different time zones, watch the opening ceremony by the time Americans see it tonight. One thing that was spectacular, a sea of 2008 drummers pounding out rhythms as the ceremony started and the drums lit up. What were we seeing there? Were the drums saying something?
I think on the surface, it was the countdown to that moment of, like you mentioned, ba ling ba ling ba, this 80808. And so really dramatizing every pulse that leads up to that moment. But it's also very characteristic of Zhang Yimou, who is the designer along with Zhang Jigang of these Olympic ceremonies.
Well, tell us that because many people feel that there's a famous film director who is behind everything we're seeing. But in fact, you say that there are some other names as well. Who do you think is really pulling the strings?
Well, Zhang Yimou and Zhang Jigang are working together. And Zhang Yimou, as some people know, is a very well-known film director whose films tend to have a kind of epic, primal tone
right,
to them.
Hero in films like that. And we saw people flying in the beginning of the ceremonies.
And so from the drumming right through the acrobatics to a lot of the colors and symbols and the conceptual arrangement would be Zhang Yimou's. But the actual choreography that you see in the drumming would be Zhang Jigang's. And he is actually a very famous choreographer that was with the People's Liberation Army until 2006. And he holds the rank of lieutenant general, which is the highest rank you can have as a non-combatant military officer. So he's very well respected by the state.
But that's his job, to choreograph the military.
Yes, he was the leader of the PLA song and dance troupe for many years and has created really wonderful award-winning performances.
Huh. That's Claire Conceson, an associate professor of drama at Tufts, a researcher at Harvard, and a Chinaphile. Her forthcoming book, Voices Carry, is the autobiography of a late Chinese actor and culture minister. We're going to talk much more with Claire. We're well aware, speaking of the military influence, that there are questions about China's human rights records. This is, after all, a country that executes 20,000 people a year. And we do want to talk when we come back. How is Claire seeing human rights sort of playing out, if at all, in the opening ceremonies? And of course, Bill, there's sports too.
Sports.
Back in a minute, here and now. We're reviewing what's been going on thousands of miles away and many time zones away in Beijing as the Olympics 2008 open there today, 8:08 on 80808, and just an incredible spectacle. Estimates of upwards of $100 million spent on this one performance. And so we want to learn more about what we were seeing. And we're here with Claire Conceson. She's associate professor of drama at Tufts University and a researcher at Harvard University's Fairbanks Center for Chinese Studies. Fluent in Mandarin, Claire?
On a good day, yes.
And, we were mentioning human rights, well aware that this is an issue. Many people feel China shouldn't have had the Olympics. Others feel that having the Olympics will open the country more. Today, earlier today, President Bush, at the dedication of the new U.S. embassy in Beijing, once again called on the Chinese to, quote, let people say what they think. But this is a country that doesn't brook dissent. What are we seeing? We spoke earlier about how we're seeing the characters of peace and harmony all over, and words to that effect in English, all over the Olympic village.
But what are we seeing, for instance, about China's many ethnic groups?
Well, I would just like to make a point here that when spectacle occurs, to a certain extent, as I mentioned before, China is controlling the spectacle and relaying certain messages. But then there's this thing called framing. And in performance studies, when we look at the framing of a performance, China is not in total control of that. And what I've seen over the past weeks and months is that China's Olympic ceremonies and Olympics is getting framed in reference to, for example, Korea's 1988 Olympics or Berlin's 1936 Olympics, and also by the current events that have taken place leading up to the Olympics. So the riots in Tibet, the Sichuan earthquake, and the torch relay protests in Paris, and the different comments by Sarkozy and Bush about human rights. So China has to try to navigate this framing because it's not creating the frame for itself. And I think in the terms of these other Olympics, people hoped perhaps that by giving the Olympics to China, it would help foster democratization like what happened in Korea. And certainly we don't want to be too quick to compare it to the Berlin Olympics, which was a very, you know, fascist regime. But these comparisons are happening. So I think China is trying to combat these comparisons by offering a very diverse view of its culture, celebrating its 55, 57, by some accounts, ethnic minorities, and trying to show that it's responding to the critiques of the world and trying to have an open dialogue. But of course, people have very different feelings about whether China's actually doing this.
Well, and as this is all happening as a Uyghur separatist group sent out a warning threatening attacks during the game. So it's very vibrant. But you mentioned too, and I just briefly, if you could remind us, that different people watch different Olympic Games in different ways. You talk about the Salt Lake City Olympics here in the U.S. and how the world watched one scene where Mormon wagon trains came onto the stage, if you will, in the stadium. And there were Indians also on the same stage on the field. And to the world, it looked like the wagon trains were pushing the Indians off the stage. Now, Americans might not have seen it that way.
Yes, I think this is a byproduct of how performances are staged. And even though they're planned and rehearsed, we're not always fully aware of their implications until the spectacle happens. And what I witnessed watching those opening Olympics was this wonderful establishment of the Native American tribes of the Salt Lake region, followed by the Mormon pioneers. But in physically moving one group of performers off the stage and another group on, you had the reenactment of basically a genocide. And that's certainly not what they intended from that narrative. Yeah. Yes.
Bill Littlefield is here as well from NPR's Only a Game. And Bill, I want to bring in someone who I know you know well. He's U.S. Olympic gold medalist David Silk. David, you there?
I'm here.
I played for the U.S. ice hockey team in the 1980 Lake Placid Winter Games. And, you know, David, just first of all from you, what are you guessing these athletes are feeling at this huge spectacle, bigger, much bigger than even the one you were in the middle of? What are you guessing they're feeling?
Well, it certainly is much bigger than our little romp through the Lake Placid Polo Club in February of 1980. It was, I think the Lake Placid High School football field was being used, so they decided to change the venue to the Polo Club. But I think that most of the athletes will take in the opening ceremonies in terms of the pomp and pageantry and really enjoy the festivities. And I think it's a time to clear their heads of all of the competition and preparation and the mental preparedness that they need to have. I think it's a nice mental break for them, and they can really enjoy. I would say that it's a one time prior to competing that they can really enjoy what the Olympics are all about.
I think you bring up a really interesting point there, Dave, because unlike the U.S. hockey team when you guys were at Lake Placid, the gigantic majority of athletes going to an Olympics know that they're not going to win a medal. They know that they're there to do the very best they can at the very most important competition they've ever been involved in, but they also know they're not going to win. And the spectacle and the joy of playing and the great opportunity to join athletes from so many different countries and meet people and all the rest of that, that really is what it's about for most of these men and women.
I think in many ways a lot of the athletes have already won. The fact that they're on the Olympic team, that they've made the teams, that they're representing their country you know, that they're flying the colors, so to speak, is already their victory of sorts.
There's athletes from Iraq and Afghanistan there, Bill. The athlete carrying the U.S. flag is a former lost boy from Sudan.
Right. My favorite statistic as far as that goes is Pakistan. Pakistan is sending 35 people to the Olympics, 21 male field hockey players and 14 male field hockey officials. That's the entire
that's
group. Now, I don't know if that ratio represents the record for number of officials per athlete, but it is interesting.
Got to be close.
that's how Pakistan is approaching these games.
We have a minute left. David, just a few seconds. Just an athlete that jumps out that you're watching.
Well, besides Amanda Baird, I think that... I don't think that there's one athlete. I think Michael Phelps certainly is one to watch.
Both swimmers.
I was going to say, when did you start watching Amanda? And you don't have to answer that question if you don't want to.
Well, a lot of what us are watching Dara Torres, the 41-year-old swimmer. But we'll be watching it with all of you over the next couple of weeks. Bill Littlefield of NPR's Only a Game, David Silk, U.S. Olympic gold medalist from the hockey team in 1980. And we also want to thank Claire Conceson, Associate Professor of Drama at Tufts, researcher at Harvard, China File, for her expertise. We're going to call on it for the next couple of weeks. Thank you all so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Bye now.
And we'll be tuning in tonight. And as we said, whenever we talk Olympics, we'll let you know in advance. Back after the news of the day, here and now. To the topic of Afghanistan now, where it's been a deadly summer for American troops. 55 members of the U.S. military were killed in combat in June and July, fighting against the resurgent Taliban. Because of the war in Iraq, additional U.S. troops won't be available to boost American forces in Afghanistan until next year. So today, Secretary of Defense Robert Gates is pushing a plan to double the size of the Afghan army. But Gates and both presidential candidates agree that more American troops should be sent to Afghanistan. Well, our next guest, at least according to news reports, disagrees. Retired Army General Barry McCaffrey is now an ABC analyst, a private consultant, although not to any candidates or the government. He's also adjunct professor of international affairs at West Point, just back from a trip to Afghanistan. General McCaffrey, what is your take on Afghanistan today?
Well, Robin, by the way, probably slightly different characterization of what I came back and said in my report. It's not that I disagree so much that we'll need more combat forces, particularly in the short run, because the fighting is intensified. The Taliban are clearly attempting to wipe out small NATO units. So probably we're going to be forced into deploying another brigade, two or three. My concern had been that that's not going to solve the problem.
By the way, how many in a brigade?
5,000-6,000 troops. In other words, right now we're there with two infantry brigades and our NATO allies, and really only the Brits, Canadians, and the Dutch have any political will to engage in combat with Taliban forces. Afghanistan is in abject misery, poverty, infant and mother mortality. Agricultural products are defunct except for a $4 billion a year opium heroin industry. So the place is really a mess with dysfunctional, corrupt, or non-existent local government at district and provincial level. So you got to build the Afghan police and the Afghan army. So I was, just delighted to read Secretary Gates essentially has agreed to just double the size of the Afghan army. We can't police provide internal security in the urban areas and villages of Afghanistan for the next 25 years. So the political campaign was making me nervous with both Senator McCain and Senator Obama one-upping each other on, allegedly how many brigades they deployed to the fight in Afghanistan.
And I want to make sure we're clear on that because, yes, you have a written report that we've looked at, and it seemed to be saying that you don't think that more American troops is the answer. Are you saying that doubling the Afghan troops is equally important? What are you saying about American troops going back?
It's undoubtedly going to be a requirement to send more U.S. combat forces. In fact, I can't imagine we'd wait till next year. I think there's probably a requirement for one brigade in the very near future.
But are they available? Are the troops available? We're reading because of the war in Iraq, they're not available right now.
the U.S. Army is starting to unravel. Of course, you know, the thing's been overloaded for the last 3, 4, 5 years. You know, we're getting huge loss rates among mid-career NCOs and young officers, and our equipment's getting wrecked. We're in trouble. The Congress and the administration did not resource the national security strategy that they embarked on. And by, that's not just the president, that's the Congress also. But what I argue is not against a short-term combat deployment. It's an undue focus on thinking that is going to be the solution. The solution is building Afghan police force and to have them present in all 398 districts and 34 provinces, and that takes time and equipment and police mentors. And also, I think, you know, even in the Afghan army, which is a splendid success, a tiny little 60,000-man army, taking the majority of the casualties in Afghanistan, you've got to build the security forces and not think that the U.S. and its fairly shaky NATO allies can fight our way out of the problem.
Well, according to the New York Times, Secretary Gates is also calling for a restructuring of the military command of American and NATO forces in response to the Taliban resurgency. You say in your report there's no unity of command in Afghanistan. NATO is supposed to be in charge of stabilizing the country, but the U.S. troops are doing the fighting. So your sense of the structuring of the military there?
By the way, it's not uncommon for us to have overseas engagements where there's no political or military unity of command. But in this case, it's particularly egregious. You've got a tremendous disparity between what the U.S. and its coalition allies can do in terms of combat and the NATO side of the house, which is roughly half the force on the ground. I think Secretary Gates is going to try and get some better coherence and at least have the U.S. four-star general, Dave McKiernan, who's the NATO commander, to say, by the way, in addition, you're now the senior U.S. element commander for non-NATO committed forces. Some of the things we'll probably continue to have in U.S. unilateral command, the counterterrorism force, and possibly, but unlikely, the training element for the Afghan army and police, which right now is a U.S.-directed operation. That should at some point become NATO's.
General McCaffrey, I feel we've had this conversation before. I feel in the war in Iraq, there was a phase where people talked about boosting the police. In fact, state police from here in Massachusetts went to train Iraqis, boosting Iraqi forces. Then there was deteriorating security, a rising insurgency, and suddenly the surge of U.S. troops was presented. And there's a perception now that that surge has worked, at least in the short term, in tamping down violence. It feels as if we're on that same slope in Afghanistan, talking about boosting Afghan troops and police, but the unraveling security situation, isn't that going to lead to a surge of U.S. troops in Afghanistan?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that's an astute observation. By the way, I might add, though, that you can't have undue focus on the military component. When you deal with Afghanistan, you have to build roads, confront the opium crop, and try and develop an Afghan police and army, and that's going to be your first priority.
That's retired General Barry McCaffrey, also adjunct professor of international affairs at the U.S. Military Academy, analyst for NBC News, just returned from Afghanistan. His report saying that there may be a need for more U.S. troops in Afghanistan, but the real need is to boost the Afghan troops and police and provide security in the country, roads, etc. General McCaffrey, we appreciate your insight, but we have a question for you, an email from a listener, Tom Cuffell of Spring Valley, Illinois. And I'm sure you are prepared for this question. He's saying, pretty much, wasn't General McCaffrey's view on wars co-opted by the Department of Defense? And Tom Cuffell is referring to the New York Times report that revealed that you and dozens of military advisors were part of groups created by the White House to make the case for the war in Iraq. As one of them said, in hindsight, we were hosed by the Bush administration. How independent is your assessment now? I'm sure you're asked.
Well, the country may well have been hosed by the Bush administration, although I think that's a debatable argument. But it's hard to imagine that I was a shill for the Rumsfeld Pentagon. Tell people, go on, you know, Google, and you get probably 14,000 hits of me criticizing Secretary Rumsfeld for his egregious misjudgments. I've tried to be balanced and objective. I'm 100% supportive of the U.S. Armed Forces. My son's an infantry soldier in the Army, so I am standing behind our deployed military forces.
General McCaffrey, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Yeah, good to be with you.
Okay, just a reminder, you can go to our website and download a podcast. Take us with you wherever you go this summer. That's here-now.org. You're listening to Here and Now. Lee Israel was a respected biographer who had access to private collections of their most intimate letters of her subjects. Then, in 1991, her work dried up, and she began forging letters, embodying fading actress Louise Brooks, or mistress of the one-liner Dorothy Parker, or here, actor and playwright Noel Coward, writing ostensibly to a friend about the impending film production of Star, the story of Gertrude Lawrence, his dear friend.
Julie Andrews is set for the title role. She is about as much like Gertie as I am Edna Ferber's twin. But what can one do? I liked her athletic careering whilom nunned in The Sound of Music. She is a bright, talented actress and quite attractive since she dealt with her monstrous English overbite. It will be interesting, more interesting, I hope, than dear Gertie's actual life.
That fake letter, along with another one forged by Lee Israel, was printed in a collection of Coward letters in 2007, all told, working on vintage typewriters in her book-filled Manhattan one-bedroom. Lee Israel fabricated and sold about 400 letters before she was caught by the FBI, served a sentence of 5 years probation, 6 months house arrest. Her new memoir is Can You Forgive Me? And she joins us from the Carnegie Hall Studios in New York. Welcome.
Hi. I also think I got off easy, haven't seen my apartment.
House arrest in your apartment, in particular with overflowing litter boxes because of the cat that started the whole thing. Do we understand you had a fading cat who needed medical help?
She was the proximate cause. I mean, I was dead broke and in a lot of trouble with my landlord and with my life. And finally, it was my darling kitty got ill, and I couldn't even afford to pay for the test that the vet had to do in order to try to determine what was going on with her. And so my cat done it.
Well, let's just get a sense of what you've done. For instance, let's stay with the Noel Coward letter that you forged. Take us through it. How did you come up with the lines, for instance?
Well, the lines are some of them mine. Well, all of them mine. The lines, the verbatim, the word for word. But the stuff, the dates, the datum, the events, all of his marvelous parties. I got all of the information from the Noel Coward diaries.
Yeah. Well, and you researched the look of letters as well. When it came to Coward, you knew he left five spaces between sentences.
Yeah.
And indentations of 13 spaces between graphs.
Yeah.
And then you got letterheads of many of these writers. How'd you do that?
Well, that I did by going to the library, which was a second home to me because I did all my work there and my research there, and I found a real letter in all cases, and I had the letter copied there at the library. Then I went to a series of printers in New York, and lo and behold, I had blank stationery on which to make up my Noel Coward.
And you did it often in, you know, paper from the period. You even once went to one of those wonderfully run-down of another era hotels and lifted the paper from the hotel?
Yeah, that was for Betty Davis, and I actually didn't continue to do Davis, but there was some, it's a wonderful, very well-known Lombardi on the east side of New York. I think Joan Rivers lives there. Davis used to stay there. I met her there because she wanted me to do a biography, so I knew the Lombardi was hers. So into the lobby, I sat at one of their very French desks. I opened the drawer. I saw this lovely, creamy Lombardi letterhead, and I took six or seven of them, fully intending to type Betty Davis letters on them, which I finally didn't do because it turned out that Betty just wasn't that marketable.
Well, and when it came to the most important part of authenticating a letter, the signature, you practiced on an old TV set that you had. Explain that.
It was the first time I'd ever tried to forge a signature. I don't even think I did it in school, you know. And, for instance, I'd take a Louise Brooks signature and I'd sit and try to copy it, you know, letter for letter, look it to my left, writing with my right hand, and it just didn't look any good. It was slow. It was awkward. And it looked like what I think the dealers called Forger's palsy, which is to say that it shook. So I decided that the way to do it was to put a blank piece of paper on top of a model, a Paragon, a matrical Louise Brooks, and with the paper on top and with a television set functioning as a light box, I riffed. I didn't go line by line and punctilious period by period. I riffed. I saw it, I did it, and I just sort of riffed on it. Quite good, it turned out.
Lee Israel, many of the dealers that you sold fake letters to with fake signatures from Noel Coward or Dorothy Parker have forgiven you. Naomi Hample of the Argosy Bookshop says she's over it, and the letters were good. She says she lost thousands when she had to destroy the fakes, but you only made $100 per letter. The dealers sold the letters for $2,500. Well, we're having the same struggle some reviewers have had. Because who wants to endorse crime? But this is a great read, a great book. So do you feel at all guilty for scamming people and now making a profit with your book?
Do I feel guilty? Robin, I felt guilty during my dark days. I called my mother, who was aged at that time, told her I needed money for the rent and I needed it then, and she would she please transmit some to me via Western Union. And she went out in the pouring rain, and she fell down, and she hurt herself. Then I felt guilty. I am aware of the fact that what I did was wrong, but I am not repentant. I am aware that I did something that was ethically and morally wrong. I do not have any cheesy thing in the pit of my stomach when I think about it.
Well, except that you also note that, you've paid in other ways. You've been banned from these research libraries that were the citadel for you. I mean,
Yes, I did. And I suspect I'll be limited in my choice of books because of the fact that my choice of libraries and archives were severely limited.
You know, the fact that some of these people that you picked were kind of like blowsy, you know, were pretty quick with the rapier line. And did some of that assuage your guilt a little bit?
Yeah, I suspect. I mean, I think the people I did, with the possible exception of Edna Ferber, they would have gotten a kick out of this.
Well, now to the other question that the book raises. Why should we believe what's in the book?
Because basically the book is dispositive. I show you sometimes line by line where it came from and how it was transposed and the letters that resulted from my forgeries. And you have to remember, too, Robin, that this book was brought out or was conceived in the very beginning of what I call Memoir Gate, when all these fake memoirs were going around. This book was vetted for hour upon hour upon hour. This thing is kosher.
Well, let's take a look at another letter. This is on page 65. This is from American poet and writer and caustic commentator Dorothy Parker to someone named Joshua at Thanksgiving. Now, one of Dorothy Parker's famous lines, she was criticizing a book, "This is not a novel to be tossed aside lightly. It should be thrown with great force." So
the real good lines of Dorothy's, I hadn't heard that one. It's darling.
Great one.